Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm talking for the first time to a writer, Naeem Mirr, who has written a novel, The Perfect Man, which has been published by Random House. It is his third book. The first was called The Boy, and the second was called The Genius of the Sea. And I'll begin by saying it's one of the strangest books I've read in years, with the additional piece of information that I particularly like strange books, and that, like most strange books, its strangeness may be my hallucination, because the book is very compelling, very interesting. The moment you step away from it, though, you say, that's very strange. Now, in his first novel, The Boy, Naeem Mirr invented a character who reinvents himself. He's a changeling of sorts, and we encounter him in different contexts. In some, he seems significantly innocent. In others, depending on who's looking at him, he seems completely depraved. And it's this indecision on the reader's part between what is innocence and what is intentional depravity. Is this character a victim or a victimizer? That makes the book so morally fascinating. So too in The Perfect Man. And I wanted to begin by asking you, is there a certain vantage point from which the moralities in these books can be in some way aligned or explained?
I think that's always a difficult thing, because I never, you know, as a writer, I never set out to write anything that you know, I don't think about morality at all when I'm writing. But I do think that there are just certain lines about the idea of perfection, of trying to be perfect. I think writers are obsessed with perfection. I think that's why they write in a way that you write out of some wrongness or some wound, and you produce something in the book that you hope is perfect, is a perfect thing. Of course, it never is. And so that is your constant way of being as a writer. And so with The Perfect Man, we begin with a very, very bad man. In fact, it's not even the father of Rajiv, who's the central character. It's actually the father of that father, a person that he talks about as this very evil man who is now dead and is becoming sort of the mythic badness that begins the book. And at the end of the book, we have Rajiv faced with a moral dilemma. Is he going to be a decent human being or not? Is he going to make one choice or another? And the whole book in some way, although it contains many other characters, is about what it is that allows him to ultimately make the choice that he makes. Although, of course, the final image of the book is sort of equivocal. So, you know, when I do look back at the book, I think I do see this sort of impulse toward trying to be good, trying to even be more than good, which is perfect, which is, of course, disastrous in many ways.
Well, I find very interesting this idea that a book comes out of a wound of sorts, and that it means to be a perfect evocation of that wound. In other words, a very symmetrical and aesthetically perfect image of something that in the world may be simple brokenness. And I do agree with you that many novels are about the understanding of the wound. In fact, one of the characters here in The Perfect Man by my guest Naeem Murr is described in front of a church congregation as a suppurating wound.
Right.
And the book itself seems to move in something like a clear-eyed state from people who do not like to be touched, who are nevertheless seeking love, who can barely speak to other people who are seeking marriage, mm-hmm. people who have been revealed as willing to allow their friends to rape their daughter, mm-hmm. And this, worse still, revealed to be the subject of a $1 bet,
mm-hmm.
that there's a place in which things that we regard as never going without saying go without saying here.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think, and I think that there's a particular pressure of all of that on the fact that so many of the central characters are children, so that we have that sort of pressure that exists outside them. You know, in which they're sort of caught and pressured. But I think, I mean, for me, all fiction that I love is about intimacy. I mean, I think the central human problem is that, you know, you're there and I'm here, and how do we bridge that? You know, in what ways do we bridge it? And, you know, what do we develop to bridge that? And as you say, so many of these characters in some sense present the problem of intimacy.
Now, we start in the 1950s with a young boy, Rajiv, whose mother had been bought for £20 by an Englishman. He is born. The mother, in essence, disappears, and he's taken to England by his father, who gives the young boy, Rajiv, to his brother to raise. Mm-hmm. There in England, the boy is so teased for the color of his skin, for his difference, that he learns to mimic. He acculturates by becoming as vicious and teasing as the people around him. He's led by boys to draw a swastika on the wall of a Jewish teacher's classroom, and he comes, it seems, to believe that the way he can function is by providing the nightmare image of the worst that could be said or done by a child.
Mm-hmm.
He's sent to America to be raised by the third brother and his common-law wife, a writer of romances, Ruth, and on the day of his arrival, this third brother commits suicide by taking poison, and Ruth, who has never been married, is given the boy to raise against her own inclinations,
mm-hmm.
and her own better judgment. All of this happens very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get the sense that this is a world of outsiders,
mm-hmm.
that we're entering a community, the community where Ruth lives, which is called Pisgah, yes?
Mm-hmm.
And it is an incestuous, gossiping, close-minded community,
mm-hmm.
into which this stranger child who has come intuitively to believe that one survives by stirring up the worst, has come.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's trying to protect himself, and he protects himself by mimicking, and he protects himself by simply not revealing himself. He has very dark skin, which means, of course, something in Missouri at that time. But he has an English accent, and so all of these things are sort of make him a very, I think, confusing to the people around him. But he's impenetrable until finally that final chapter sort of opens him up in the future. And he then himself gets a chance to look back at this very, as you say, a very sort of self-enclosed world and pressured world that is also with itself, that world is caught within a very raw but sort of Edenic world of woods and streams, you know, sort of this wild, and it's mystery really that surrounds the world and that pressures the world.
The community itself, if in the same way as we don't know this original father of the three brothers who has been very bad indeed, similarly the community that we know seems initiated by an act in its past that has taken place at night in which an autistic child has been murdered at an event that seems from the very beginning to be something like the lynching of an innocent man. And the mood, the atmosphere here is one of what they like to call motiveless malignity. And in fact, Othello and the character of Iago comes up. So the book seems to be asking a question about what is the relation of the perfect man to a radically imperfect world in which motiveless malignity rules. The perfect man is, that phrase occurs from the romance novelist who seems to regard the perfect man as the perfect man of the romance novel. Impulsive, passionate, sweeping others up. And she comes to know, probably always knows, that he doesn't exist. So we're left with the idea of perfection in a radically imperfect world and the idea of love in a world in which the characters almost inevitably have stopped loving each other. So the fallen world's yearning for some notion of perfection seems to generate the dream that underlies this book.
Well, I think that's true. I think there is love, though. I mean, I think, for example, the final love between Rajiv and Annie, which builds all the way through. I think the children probably are sort of a purer form. But yes, I mean, that's a, that, I think that's a wonderful way to put it, this sort of longing for perfection. But, you know, it's interesting because it, I think it makes it sound like a very dark, it is a dark book, but it isn't a book that for me is pessimistic. And I think in part, because of form. I mean, form itself, I think, is a form of optimism, that it has a very a particular and sort of it's the way it's conceived.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Naeem Murr, author most recently of The Perfect Man, published by Random House. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Naeem Murr about The Perfect Man. Now, first of all, you describe form as being optimistic, whereas I tend to think that except for certain kinds of aesthetes, like, say, Nabokov, who thinks of form as being a conduit to bliss, that for many it's a neutral value, not an optimistic one. So I wonder why you say that.
I think it's just art. I think it's just facing the human predicament in a way that even if there's a lot of chaos, there's a lot of bad in this book, but it's very much also a made thing. You know, it's not for me to say that it's well made, but it, you know, for me, it's a thing that has really been conceived and that has a shape and that has, I hope, a kind of a coherence, that it's not. And that to me can never be a pessimistic act. So I think that that's what I sort of meant in that way, just the importance of form, of art, really, as an optimistic act.
It does seem as if the book is about transformation. This young boy comes to the community, and it's largely centered around three or four friends mm-hmm. that he makes. The form seems to be Shakespearean comedy. I thought of Midsummer Night's Dream. Mm-hmm. There are two couples of children on the verge of transformation, caught in not the woods, as in Midsummer Night's Dream, but making a decision between the woods and the town, mm-hmm. between escape and civilization mm-hmm. in some way. Mm-hmm. And it's almost as if they're in a whirligig. Mm-hmm. The characters will combine and recombine. Almost every combination is examined. Mm-hmm. And they seem to be looking for what?
Well, I think I think they're looking for otherness. A lot. I think what young people often are looking for is the thing that is really not what they are in some radical way at first, until you begin to establish a meaningful or real intimacy. I think, and it depends upon their situation. I think Lewis is looking for something to stabilize himself. Lewis is slowly going mad, and Annie is sort of becomes the last thing that is real for him in the world, in what we would think of as the real world, before he begins to essentially begins to create his own world out there, his own God. Everything is being created out in the woods. And in some ways, of course, he's connected with the mystery that surrounds the town, the person they call the man in the woods with his white dog, this mysterious figure out there, and he is really becoming that figure who will also be sacrificed. So I think people are, I mean, certainly Nora is looking for otherness in Rajiv. She sees him as a way out of everything that she knows, and she's, of course, in a pretty bad situation. I think that each one, Alvin is looking to be connected to anyone at all, anyone, and so he moves really between those two couples. They're really the couples that interchange, as you say. That's the whirligig, and Alvin exists very much between them.
You know, William Gass calls it the heart of the heart of the mm-hmm. country, mm-hmm. and there is a sense here that we're looking at something going on dead center mm-hmm. in America, in the world?
In the world. Well, I think in some sense, I mean, the worlds that I create, I think always, the worlds exist only for the characters. I was very moved by Missouri when I was there, simply because it was so fecund. So, I mean, these streams, the waters, the eerie landscape of the floodplains, it's very raw as well and exposed, you know, and it's full of fossils. It's very layered. And that's provocative, but this world, even though it's set in this Missouri, in this imaginary town, this world exists entirely for the characters. What needs to be around them is around them, and of course, as the writer, you make that as real as possible. And I think hopefully it is very real, and it seems real, but it isn't. This world exists for them, exists for their predicaments. It emerges out of their predicaments and their conditions. And as I say, when I look back at it, I grew up in London. I grew up in a big block of flats full of immigrant families, and it was an incredibly porous place. And so as a child, I would be in and out of all of these houses, and children then were very much beneath notice. And so you would see an awful lot of very inappropriate adult behavior, and a lot of these were very working-class people. So it was a real sort of soup, a human soup. I think that this world in some ways emerges out of many of those memories in this completely new place. And I would not have said that except after I'd written the book. When I look back at it, I think, okay, that's that sort of porous place in which you're surrounded by these adults. And you're constantly observing them and trying to think about what it is that you're ultimately going to become, whether consciously or otherwise. And then it is surrounded by this Edenic, the mystery. It's surrounded by mystery, by the woods and what's in the woods. And in some sense, in that way, it is the world.
Now, I wonder how much of the book's outsider sensibility comes first from being born in, I believe, Lebanon and raised in London and coming to America, but as I understand it, being an itinerant writer. I mean, I think if I understand it aright, you've been in more writing programs than any other writer I know, so that there's almost, no possibility of a stable community, rather moving from community of artists to community of artists, learning the craft, working, I assume, with writers who interest you. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that the condition of being a looker from afar and from outside has to be then the condition of narration.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think there. I think that has been. I my mother was actually Irish, and she gave my brother and I in London. After we come back from Lebanon and we're in my grandmother's council flat, she gave us a false accent. We had a fake English accent. She didn't want us to have an Irish brogue, so that there were so many levels of remove that we had in terms of the way that we spoke, in terms of what cultures were influencing us. As young children, we had spoken Arabic, and then that is now lost to time, but I'm sure it exists there somewhere, as well as the memory of the lost. We lived in the hills around Beirut. And so that there was something lost there, and there was an incredible disconnection. And then when I came here, I never really truly – I went to a lot of writing programs, but really because I wanted to stay here. I felt so alienated in England that I didn't go to writing programs truly to go to writing programs. I went because – they gave me an opportunity to write, and that's what I did. I just wanted to write and wanted to find anywhere where I could find some time to write. So I was never interested truly in going to school to learn anything but how to write. So I think there is that, and I think all of my books contain at their heart a kind of completely liminal character, a character, Rajif in this one, in The Genius of the Sea, there's a man called Amos who was like a dream figure, a trickster figure, And a figure who is exactly at the border. I think I'm obsessed with borders.
And doorways. And,
right.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes, and it seems that what's happening is that unless cautious, this generation of children surrounding this Indian boy will repeat what has happened in the previous generation and the previous generation, back as far as England, and that what this book is about is a rigorous attempt by an outsider to break the tradition of being an outsider. Like the condition of yearning for parents when you have none, or wanting there to be a beating heart at the center of things, where these children instead most often find fossils or abandoned skulls, that they're looking to move almost mystically from head to heart and from fossil to live presence.
To connect, yes.
To connect. Does that describe the writer as well?
I think the writer is it's a dreadful position to be in some ways, because, as I say, for me, human beings are everything. I mean, that's my central passion ever since I was as young as I can remember, was just people. I mean, what was going on inside them, what they were, the mystery, the central mystery. And the thing is that my mother was she's a wonderful woman who's very secretive about a pretty terrible past. And I think as a young child, you see into that, and that how you get to it is through her gestures, through the every single minor movement and flicker of the eyes, everything that is it comes to you in a kind of intimacy. You understand that there's something there, there's something behind that, and so you're fantastically intimate, incredibly intimate with something that you do not know and that you cannot penetrate. And I think that is the position of almost all writers that I know, is that they're obsessed with connection and human beings, but because in some ways almost because of that obsession, they're so distantly separated from other humanity. I mean, that you're constantly in this paradox of connection, of trying to read and understand what a human being is while being absolutely disconnected from them. And I think that's a really, it's a difficult place to be. That's the liminal place. That's the border place, which I think it's very difficult to be in for any length of time without. I think that's why so many writers are drunks and so on. You can't be there for very long without it beginning to corrode.
Now, if that's true, is writing the book both an attempt to bridge that distance, which of necessity reinforces it?
I think so. I think for me now, of course, I think most writers would say this, well, now I feel very distant from the book itself. You know, I was so much a part of it, and it's come so much out of me and out of my life. And yet, once it is separated from you, you know, and of course, it hasn't perfected you. It hasn't, you know, it is what it is. It's like a child is what a child is. And then all at once, you feel complete separation. It's absolutely separated from you, and you can barely recognize it. You barely know who these people are. And so it's a very strange process because you're obsessed with them. They fill your life. They are your life, absolutely, in the process of writing the book. And then it becomes a completely alienated object, you know, to you. And that's why it's, you know, when you meet readers and they talk to you about the characters and things, you suddenly get this glimmer of there's light, you know, there is a life there. So,
I've been speaking with Naeem Mir, author most recently of The Perfect Man, published in an original paperback edition by Random House. Thank you, Naeem, for joining me.
Thank you so much.
You can read an excerpt from The Perfect Man at kcrw.com/bookworm. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.